Notice the wordless quality. You will not be thinking thoughts about having no thoughts. This is a nonverbal knowing. Notice the sense of inner composure and the undistracted singleness of mind. Third jhana. The third jhana is similar to the second, except it feels even smoother and more refined as rapture fades, leaving only pleasure. With the fading away of rapture, he abides in equanimity, mindful and clearly aware, feeling pleasure with the body. He enters and abides in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, equanimous and mindful he abides in pleasure. At some point, the rapture we previously suffused throughout the body to access the first jhana begins to feel too energetic and coarse. The mind wants to settle further, and rapture gives way to a quieter pleasure in the body and happiness in the mind. For some, the rapture fades on its own as the third jhana begins to reveal itself. If this does not happen for you on its own, try inclining your mind. See if you can let go into the feeling of happiness or pleasure, something lighter than the rapture. If you are aware of your breathing, you can use it to help dissipate the rapture if that is strong. Equanimity, mindfulness, and clear awareness are highlighted in the third jhana's definition. Our consciousness can be so filled by the rapture of the first and second jhanas that we may not notice the stability and clear awareness of our minds. As rapture subsides, mindfulness and equanimity come to prominence. With attainment of the third jhana, the simile changes quite a bit. He makes the pleasure divested of rapture drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. Just as in a pond of blue or red or white lotuses, some lotuses that are born and grow in the water thrive, immersed in the water without ever rising out of it, and cool water drenches, steeps, and pervades them from their tips to their roots, so there is no part of those lotuses unpervaded by the cool water. So too, a faiku, monk, makes the pleasure drench, steep, and pervade the body. There is no sense of doing here at all. There is more a sense of being. These lotuses are born, live their entire lives, and die completely suffused in the water. They do not have to do anything to make it happen. In the third jhana, the pleasure is suffused throughout your body without you doing anything to make it happen. It is a state of being, not of doing. Fourth jhana. Here is the definition of the fourth jhana. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, he enters and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness and equanimity. And here is the simile. He sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. Just as though a man were sitting covered from head to foot with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of his body not covered by the white cloth, so too a bhikkhu, monk, sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, you enter a state of great balance. There is no sense of doing, only a sense of being, and you just remain there. In the fourth jhana, you are powerfully immersed in body awareness, a state of profound connection. With the settling out of rapture and pleasure, perceptions of your body become quite thin, and what remains is resting at peace in a bright, inclusive, equanimous awareness. Your experience of your body may be subtle. There may not be much to experience in the body at this point, as the previous coarser perceptions melt into vibration or light. After jhana. Once we are in any of the stages of jhana, our practice includes times of doing nothing and allowing the experiences and insights to reveal themselves, and times of inclining our minds toward investigation and inquiry. In the next chapter, we will explore the various ways insight arises and its place on the path toward the ultimate goal of meditation, awakening and liberation through non-clinging. As our familiarity with jhana grows, we learn to navigate the terrain, exploring the landscape of consciousness with increasing skill. We gain facility in moving about among the various levels and how to access and use pleasure to gladden our hearts and minds. As we touch the pleasure of concentration, the allure of worldly pleasure fades. A contented heart and mind are subtler, yet more satisfying, than anything that can be found through the ordinary senses. We see that we do not have to go looking outside ourselves. Worldly pleasure loses its attraction as we learn to let go into the more refined pleasure of concentration. Jhana, like every other experience we can have, is not a reliable place to seek happiness. Though all of the jhanas are highly pleasant, even the purified realm of the fourth jhana contains the seeds of potential suffering. Each jhana has its own level of subtlety and satisfaction, but they all contain a degree of dissatisfaction. From the perspective of the earlier stages in meditation, the first jhana is appealing. From the perspective of the fourth jhana, it can feel rather crude. By the time you have reached the fourth jhana, your mind is keenly aware and you are able to perceive clinging on the subtlest levels. The jhanas are temporarily satisfying, but not completely satisfying, and clinging to jhana, or to any meditative state, plants the seeds of suffering. And so, jhana flows us toward awakening. Previously, you realized that ordinary worldly pleasure is not fulfilling. Now you realize the pleasure of meditative states is not going to do it for you either. None of these states last, and once the energy of the meditation melts away, we are lifted out and back into the ordinary world. Now there is no turning back. This mind, which is purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, flexible, steady, and attained to imperturbability, now turns in a very profound way toward liberation. Chapter 9. Insight. In the beginning instructions, you were advised to find a posture where you could be as comfortable as possible. You could sit in a chair or even lie down, finding whatever best supported you to be relaxed, easeful, and alert. You did not have to make anything happen. All you had to do was be with your experience. By now, you have seen how hard this simple notion, just to sit quietly and be present with yourself, can be. The idea of non-clinging is simple, but one of the first insights we have is that the seemingly straightforward instruction, to be with ourselves, is hard to do. Letting go and non-clinging is easy when things are going your way, but you soon find all the ways you are unable to be present. You begin to uncover layer upon layer of reactive patterns pushing and pulling you in all directions. From all the times of sitting through knee pain or backache, staying with the practice when your mind would not cooperate or when you were visited by old memories or emotional pain, you learned to find moments of freedom in the midst of it all. And you discovered your edges, the places where you were not yet ready or able to let go of struggle, and learned how elusive the happiness of non-clinging can be. Insight into anything means understanding its true nature. It is an intuitive knowing, direct perception of what is essentially true beyond mere intellectual understanding. To progress from a conceptual understanding of how Dharma teachings and practice might help us to actualizing the Dharma as a lived reality, we need help to realize the potential for quieting our minds and opening our hearts. We need to find the tools for meeting ourselves face to face. Through wise discernment, we penetrate beneath surface appearances to recognize what is real and true about our world and ourselves. Whenever you are suffering, it is a signal that you need to back up and look at what is keeping you from being present. And if you cannot be with that, you need to back up again and keep doing so until you find what you can be present with. Insight is the discernment of your suffering, its cause, and a way to its end in order to more fully realize your capacity for letting go. Insight is whatever perception or understanding sheds light on the places we create suffering and how to let that suffering go. Sometimes, when the light of awareness illuminates previously hidden corners of our psyche, old destructive patterns can fall away on their own. The grip of self-judgment, criticism, or doubt can loosen simply through mindful presence. Other times, mindful recognition is just the first step, a jumping-off point for delving into something more deeply, thinking it through, or feeling into it to untangle its knots. How insight leads to liberation. Just as we suffer in many ways and in many areas of our lives, so there are many forms insight can take. We can directly perceive the ephemeral nature of life through insight to impermanence and change. We can have psychological insights, insights to the nature of our body, and insights into emotions and thought patterns. Insight can manifest as the solution to a problem as we comprehend the web of causal relationships and conditioned patterns influencing our thoughts and behavior. All of these insights can be in service of deepening liberation through non-clinging. Insights can come on their own as a result of your having calmed your mind, like stilling the wind that ruffles the surface of a lake so you can see the bottom clearly. And you can aim for insights by turning toward any experience to investigate its qualities and how you are relating to what is happening. You do not have to see farther than you can see. You do not have to know where the process is leading or how to proceed. If you stay open with and receptive to the process as it unfolds, letting what happens guide you organically and using your best judgment for how to meet it, the way forward will reveal itself. You can be sitting quietly in meditation, and an old memory, long forgotten, may suddenly pop into your mind. By staying present with that memory, you may become aware that there is a feeling associated with it. Or perhaps you have a sense, maybe only a vague feeling, of something lying just below the surface of your consciousness. You may hang out with that feeling or memory, or purposefully turn your attention toward it to look closer. You might then notice a body sensation connected with the feeling or memory, maybe tightness in your belly or shoulders, or contraction in your heart. And by staying with the feeling in your body, you become aware of an emotion. Looking more closely, you remember a painful time from your childhood when you felt unsafe, and how that unsafe feeling has been simmering beneath the surface of your consciousness to this day. Insights such as these promote deep psychological healing, revealing and loosening the knots of unconscious forces that drive us. In the same way, insight into thought patterns can help us break unconscious clinging and identity. There is not much to a thought. Thoughts seem to come from nowhere, persist for a moment, floating through the mind like the wisp of a cloud, and are gone. Mundane thoughts about buying groceries or remembering an appointment do not bother us. But as insubstantial as they are, when they are not noticed, thoughts of self-criticism and judgment, views and opinions and self-images, they all generate a world of self-view and suffering that we proceed to inhabit as if it were real. We can easily mistake our critical judging mind for wise discernment. We believe our thoughts, not seeing that they are our own creation, fueled by unconscious habits and patterns. These destructive attitudes and thoughts would not be so detrimental if we could see them for what they are. This is where we need the clarity of insight, because it is only through discernment itself that we learn the difference between judging and discernment. The critical mind is like a computer program, which only knows how to do one thing, the function for which it is programmed. Clicking on the icon for a word processor will never run a video game. When you click on the computer icons in your mind, when you encounter certain people or situations and the right conditions come together, self-judgment, shame, anger, or fear are set in motion, running through the course of their programming. The critical mind is not interested in giving you an accurate assessment of yourself or others. It is only interested in carrying out its function, to criticize. And it doesn't care what it lands on. It is happy to land on you or anyone else. You are the expert on the lived experience of your life. But when you identify with your experience, you may be among the least qualified to judge yourself because you cannot see it objectively. You are too caught up, too entangled in your own life to assess it properly. Once, with discernment, you see these forces for what they really are, just conditioned patterns that run through their program when set in motion, you do not have to believe them anymore. They begin to lose their grip on you and ultimately fade away completely. The way insight arises. Insights come from within jhana and other meditative states as a direct result of the deeper stages of samadhi. Insights also come during times in meditation when you cannot concentrate, when it feels like the meditation is not going easily or well, or you are dealing with hindrances and learning how to be present with something difficult or painful. And insights come in the experience of daily activities when you are not meditating at all. Meditation practice serves to support all of these. Three marks of all experience. Insight is traditionally understood as directly perceiving one or more of the three characteristics of all experience: impermanence, the ultimately unsatisfactory nature of all things due to their being impermanent, and the selfless nature of your own being. When we perceive clearly, not as a concept, but as part of our lived experience, that things do not last, we tend not to chase after or cling to them so much, knowing that they are just going to change or be lost. Because all things are changing, if you identify with or cling to anything at all, to having or not having any experience, to your body, your mind, or anything that is bound to change, you either suffer or plant the seeds of future suffering. Knowing directly the suffering that comes from clinging because all things are impermanent helps us to let go. When you start to understand more accurately the nature of your mind and body, the fact that in essence you too are a collection of changing experiences, you can rest more at peace with the unfolding of your own being. We may understand all of this very well conceptually, but we do not live our lives as if it were true. This is why it is so important to perceive these characteristics directly. Ignorance and delusion manifest in many ways. We take what must change as lasting. We seek happiness in what is bound to be lost. And we cling to our minds and bodies, even though we know they are destined to old age, illness, and death. If you cling to your youth, you suffer. If you are enslaved to your desires, constantly changing after pleasant experiences and avoiding the unpleasant ones, you suffer or set yourself up for future suffering. Have you ever tried to hold water cupped in your hands? No matter how hard you try, it inevitably drips away through your fingers. Pressing your hands and fingers together more tightly does not help. It hurts, and the water is lost nonetheless. Everything is a changing process. Everything will pass away right through your fingers. This is not meant to make you sullen or disheartened. Life is not a mistake, and nothing is going wrong. It's just the way things are. If you release the grip and stop fighting yourself and the world, it relieves the pain. What you are left with is ease. Very young children immerse themselves in play, creating whole worlds of trucks and trains, dolls and playhouses. They are deeply engaged and absorbed in their imaginations. As they get older, the things that had been so enticing no longer hold any fascination. They did not have to do anything to make this happen. Their perceptions gradually shifted, simply as a result of a more mature perspective. What had previously captivated their attention no longer seems of interest and simply drops away on its own. Just as we lose our fascination with childhood toys as we grow older, when we see how things are, as we begin to understand impermanence and the suffering that comes from trying to hold on to anything, our clinging and suffering start to drop away. The more deeply we get it, the more we are able to let go of the subtler changes of clinging. When your mind is free from clinging, the pain of pressing your fingers together too tightly stops, and an inner peace arises as you allow the water to drip through. The happiness of inner peace is subtler than sense pleasure, but more deeply satisfying. This is a place of stillness, of equanimity, and of peace. In order to know the subtler places of clinging, you need mindfulness, clear awareness, and an undistracted, concentrated mind. Insight that arises from within samadhi. Stages of deep concentration sharpen the mind's perspective ability. When you become concentrated, your mind is less distracted and naturally more clear and aware. And if you take that to the level of jhana, you attain a level of clarity and undistractedness that was previously inaccessible. Remember what happens in the jhanas. The mind is extremely lucid and undistracted in unbroken mindfulness, with awareness suffused throughout the body. The more present, awake, and undistracted your mind is, the more clearly it perceives what is most deeply true about your world and yourself: the fact that all conditioned phenomena, all that can be known or sensed, are impermanent, and that, as such, they are ultimately unreliable sources of happiness. These insights may come on their own simply as a result of having a concentrated mind. Or you can choose to look for these insights within states of samadhi by turning your mind to more deeply investigate and perceive the nature of your body and mind. Naturally, without your having to do anything, these insights will become clearer. You become increasingly aware of the changing nature of phenomena, recognizing the suffering that comes through your clinging, and you come to know more deeply the nature of your heart, mind, and body, the fact that they are also a collection of changing experiences. These insights are great aids in letting go of clinging and helping you rest more equanimously and at peace. At this stage, the mind has reached a profound degree of clarity in jhana, but things have gotten very still, so you have less changing experience to be known by the clear mind. The ability to penetrate into experience has gotten extremely powerful, but the actual experience is so subtle, there is not a lot of experience there to penetrate into. The sense of the body can feel quite thin and subtle at this point. You may experience the body dissolving into pure energy or light. Though it may not feel like much is going on as you rest in the stillness and clarity of mind, you do not need a lot because the power of knowing, seeing, and perceiving is so strong. You penetrate whatever experience there is very clearly and deeply. The characteristics of impermanence and selflessness, the empty nature of the body and the mind, are all directly experienced as a fruit of a concentrated mind. The insights present themselves. There may be times in jhana or other deep stages of meditation when you choose to consciously, actively turn your mind toward investigation. I have described the mind in jhana as absorbed and undistracted, but while the mind is steady and unbroken mindful knowing, there remains part of the mind that you can incline in certain directions. This is a very subtle pointing of awareness, not the gross movements we are used to in ordinary consciousness. You can look for the changing nature of experience, the cause of suffering through clinging, or the nature of your own being. Insight in meditation when you cannot concentrate. The times when you cannot concentrate, when you are struggling and it feels like the meditation is falling apart, are important for the cultivation of insight, at least as important as the times of extreme clarity in samadhi, and perhaps more so. Our first instinct is to think we have to get back to the good meditation. We think something is going wrong. But nothing is falling apart, and nothing is going wrong. There is simply the arising and passing away of the present moment's experience as it has changed. Where there was peace and happiness, now we experience physical pain or emotional stress. These are special, important times in meditation, and we do not want to miss the opportunity for growth they have to offer. If you want to free yourself from suffering, then you have to understand your suffering. And if you want to understand your suffering, you have to experience the ways your mind creates suffering. If you want to be free, you would rather see your greed, your hatred, and your delusion than not. You do not have to seek suffering out. It will find you. And when it does, you should appreciate that it is a necessary and important part of the process of insight, and welcome the opportunity to change your relationship with the suffering being presented. Watch your mind when you are struggling or suffering in some way. There is a lot of dharma right there in the places where you get caught. That is the place to look, to learn where you cling and how to let it go. That is how the wisdom and insight come in. Notice how your mind responds to whatever is happening, whether it is resisting or is buffeting around or being reactive in some other way. Watch what is happening. Come to know the suffering quality of a reacting mind. This is a really important place to pay attention. Pay attention to what you do in those times. Everything you need for learning and growth is there. You experience the first noble truth directly, the suffering that arises because of clinging. The second noble truth is illuminated, the fact that it is your craving that is leading you to cling, craving for pleasant experience and wanting to get rid of unpleasant experience. You directly experience what conditions your mind to cling. Everything you need to learn about suffering, its cause and its cessation, presents itself. And you find out whether or not you are skilled enough to let go. Try not to judge the benefit of meditation just by how pleasant or unpleasant it is. Meditation is like riding a bicycle. Think about what it is like riding a bike. You go up and down the hills. Going up can hurt and not be much fun. Going down the hills feels great. You feel the wind, and it is easy and pleasant. It feels better going down, but which one do you get the most out of? You get a lot going down from the pleasure and the beauty, but it is the uphill that builds up your endurance and your legs the most. The path of meditation is sometimes called the path of purification. As you turn your attention inward, connecting deeply and intimately with yourself, parts of you that may have been hidden or covered over began to be made conscious. Simply by cultivating steady presence, the practice actually brings them up in cycles of purity and purification, and this process only accelerates as you become more collected and settled. In this way, the path of insight and the path of concentration are the same path. You will enter the deeper stages of samadhi, and then will go through cycles or times when it is not so easy, when you do not have the support of the concentration. Rather than react with and push away those experiences, you need to use those times. They serve to unmask levels of clinging you may not have been aware of. You get to find out how you can be with this unpleasant experience and if you can find a way to let go of your suffering around it. When the hindrances are strong and you cannot find your breath, your ability to work with what is happening can feel feeble, as if you were not really able to practice. It is true that in those times you may not have the strength of clarity and steadiness, but you are practicing fully and well as long as you bring your mindful attention the best you can to meet your experience. Just do the best you can. That is enough. Think of how you get good at anything. It is through practice and experience. Learning happens through the struggle. Your ability to let go will grow. Insight in daily life. There can be a tendency to view daily life practice as somehow less important than formal meditation. You may think the real benefits come mainly through exceptional states of deep samadhi, but the insights that come in daily life are at least as important as those from the subtle stages of concentration, and perhaps even more so. There are so many opportunities for insight. You get to find out how you are in relationship to the people at work, family, neighbors, and friends. You get to see when you are able to move through life with a balanced mind, and what causes you to close off from situations or people. As you find what helps you live in a balanced way and learn how to let go, there is no disconnection between meditation and any other aspect of your life. As the fruits of meditation carry into your life, you start to notice thoughts and feelings previously covered over by busyness or distraction. It can be alarming when you first begin to wake up to what is really happening in your mind. You begin to see how much of your thoughts are some version of, "Am I okay?" or "How am I going to be okay?" or "How am I going to get this?" or "How am I going to avoid that?" By bringing the mindfulness and clear awareness that you have been cultivating in formal meditation into ordinary life, it becomes clear how much of your life you spend in peace and fulfillment, and how much time is marked by worry or stress. Dharma practice seeks to shift reactive patterns of grasping and aversion. When your habitual tendencies of chasing your likes and running from your dislikes begin to loosen, you are left to rest peacefully with the ever-changing flow of your life. In order to do this, you must come to understand these patterns, and to understand them, you have to experience them. If you want to free yourself from suffering, you need to understand the forces that create suffering responses to life. But you cannot see your conditioning directly. In order to understand these patterns, you have to bring them into the light of awareness, and that only happens when the proper neural pathways are activated. The seeds of your reactive habits lie dormant, waiting for the opportunity to sprout when you encounter challenging people, places, and situations. Only under the right circumstances, when certain causes and conditions come together, do they spring forth and grow. Many of these tendencies have an opportunity to become conscious in the course of daily activities. You can be sitting in meditation, heart open and mind quiet, happily unbothered by anything because you are secluded from the stresses of your normal interactions. Then you get up from meditation to begin your day and encounter a person you dislike or hear a news story that upset you. You gain valuable insights into the ways you fall into reactivity or where your heart closes off, opening you to the possibility of freedom. See them as the opportunity for learning how to live in equanimity with a peaceful mind and an open heart. Chapter 10. Equanimity. The entire teaching of the Buddha can be viewed as making a radical shift in how we seek happiness, a shift that has far-reaching and profound consequences for our well-being. The process of transforming our relationship with our life and ourselves culminates in a mind of inner peace and non-reactive presence, the state of equanimity. Without equanimity, we tend to meet situations through unseen filters of reactivity, causing us to deny our experience or pull away from anything we dislike or chase after what we want. When you are balanced, you neither push away nor cling. You don't suppress your feelings or thoughts, but you don't get caught in or identified with them. Between reactions of grasping and aversion lies the freedom to choose your own way, how you will relate and respond to life. Equanimity is both the path and the fruit of the path. You employed equanimity the first time you set to meditate as you tried to let go of grasping and aversion and sit quietly with yourself. You may have felt tenuous and unsteady, but you did the best you could, and it was enough. Through those initial efforts, equanimity matured, and your capacity for meeting your experience grew. As you became increasingly able to turn toward and work with whatever arose in meditation, mindfulness and steadiness grew. It can seem so hard to live with a peaceful mind, an open heart, and compassion for others and ourselves. Equanimity acts as an ally, support, and shield against the 8 worldly concerns of gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, and pleasure and pain. These 4 pairs of opposites are powerful incentives driving most human behavior. We are constantly judging and comparing ourselves and our situations. You can appreciate success, but if your sense of well-being depends on it, you are setting yourself up for disappointment when the situation changes. If you are attached to honor and approval, it may feel good until you are faced with criticism. If you become egotistical, your self-worth can be based on comparing yourself to others. The more deeply you identify with your successes, the more profoundly you will identify with failure. With equanimity, you remain unshaken. Your peace and happiness are not left to chance forces outside your control, and you remain independent, gliding over the bumps of life's ups and downs. Equanimity should not be mistaken for passivity. It does not mean you are no longer engaged in life or should stop trying to change your circumstances when appropriate. But you should do all this from wisdom, not from reactivity. If you think you are supposed to stay with something when it is really too much to deal with, you fall into struggle. An acorn will eventually grow into a great oak tree, able to withstand powerful storms. When the sapling is small, it is weak and vulnerable, so one builds a fence to protect it and guard against animals or wind. There is no need for a fence once the tree has matured. Until equanimity is well developed, you are more easily blown by the winds of bother or stress. As wisdom grows and your boundary point moves out, your heart and mind can rest freely in the midst of ever more turmoil. Until then, you must find a way to back off or bring down the intensity to within a range in which you can work. Stress can be defined as the gap between your experience and your ability to be fully present in the midst of that experience without struggle. The wider the gap, the more you suffer. Equanimity means closing the gap. We create suffering through our inability to be with life as it is, and through our aversion to unpleasant, unwanted experiences. There is no problem if we do not think life is supposed to be any way other than it is. The Buddha expressed this using an analogy. He said both the ordinary and the enlightened person experience the full range of physical and mental processes, all the pleasant and unpleasant feelings available through the senses. Both experience the unpleasantness of painful physical reactions, which the Buddha likened to being struck by an arrow. The ordinary person then creates another extra layer of suffering in addition to the painful experience itself by clinging to the pleasant or fighting against the unpleasant. This, said the Buddha, is like being struck by a second arrow, whereas the enlightened person, for whom there is no gap, is struck only once. Ending destructive impulses. The equanimity of the Buddha is described as a destruction of three fundamental forces that lead to reactivity and stress. When these deeply conditioned patterns are no longer operational, you will have arrived in a state of balance and inner peace beyond any method or technique. These three tendencies of mind are closely related and reinforce each other. The first of these is ignorance, not understanding the truth of suffering, its cause, its cessation, and the way leading to its cessation, the Four Noble Truths. The insight into suffering that dispels ignorance is beyond mere intellectual understanding. It is an immediate knowing that manifests moment by moment within the reality of your life. When immersed in our pursuits, we cannot see the tension or anxiety that may be right in front of us. We experience a lack, a sense of something missing, or we are unable to let go of our aversion to whatever is difficult or painful. Always seeking satisfaction in the next great experience, we are so caught we cannot see the stress inherent in looking for happiness outside ourselves. It is due to ignorance that we do not perceive the suffering inherent in giving our well-being over to whether or not our experience is to our liking. Once we begin to wake up more fully to what is happening, to what is right in front of us, we directly experience the clinging that comes from craving and the suffering that ensues. The second tendency that destroys equanimity, seeking happiness by fulfilling sense pleasures, comes directly from ignorance. There is little or nothing we do that is not an effort to increase pleasant feelings and to decrease or avoid unpleasant feelings. This fundamental motivating force to seek happiness and avoid pain is deeply ingrained in our conditioning. It may seem counterintuitive that seeking happiness by fulfilling desires does not work in the long term, and in fact creates precisely the suffering we are trying to avoid. But gratifying desire rarely delivers its promise of happiness. It may elevate us momentarily to a state of satisfaction and contentment. Certainly there can be the immediate pleasure of fulfilling desire. But once the initial excitement or pleasure wears off, we are left back in our usual, ordinary state of mind. Desires seduce us by their promise of happiness, by the anticipation that by satisfying them, we will feel more fulfilled. We believe that if we could only discover the right things to go after and then apply ourselves properly to the task of getting them, we could attain some sort of enduring happiness that until now has escaped us. In addition to making our happiness dependent upon circumstance and creating at best a temporary happiness destined to change, seeking happiness by fulfilling desire conditions the mind for further craving. The objects of our desire can be difficult to secure. Once acquired, they often provide less pleasure or happiness than expected, and when clung to, they cause us grief when conditions inevitably change. Then, feeling empty or in need, we are once again driven to repeat the cycle. How many desires have you filled, and how often have you filled them, only to have them return, putting you on a constant treadmill, always having to satisfy them again? Alleviating the cravings associated with desire by fulfilling desire is like drinking seawater to alleviate thirst. It can be a great relief for a short while, since for the time being it eases the suffering inherent in craving, but it has the more fundamental effect of conditioning the mind to crave more. We are satiated for a while until the next craving, often for the same object or experience of the previous desire. The third force aiming us away from equanimity is called becoming. It is the drive to be something. It is not that you need to stop having a mind, a body, and a personality. It is having to be something and clinging to an identity through which you judge and compare yourself to others. That plants the seeds of suffering. Just as the potential for sense pleasure to bring lasting happiness is limited, clinging to an identity is not a reliable way to enter peace. If you are identified with your youth, you suffer when youth and beauty fade. If you are identified with your achievements, job title, or role, or to the opinions of others, your peace of mind is in the hands of forces outside your control. You do not have to stop living. You can continue to be involved with those things that bring you meaning, work life, family or friends, creative expression, and involvement in the affairs of the world. The shift is in your priorities, where you look for meaning and happiness, and in the motivating principles upon which your life is based. As you move forward in life, to the extent that you are consumed by your goals and bound up in having to have them, your happiness and well-being are dependent upon them, and you will suffer when they are not realized or when the situation inevitably changes. With a mind of equanimity, you find the balance between being connected and engaged in your life without clinging to any of it. Becoming disentangled. Equanimity is often misunderstood as being a state of indifference. We may think we are supposed to be detached witnesses, removed from the concerns of others or the world. But equanimity does not mean being numb or untouched by anything, or that no feelings can arise. Equanimity means remaining poised and centered within whatever happens. The ability to let go has nothing to do with being unfeeling or unconcerned about others, and everything to do with meeting life with balance and composure. The ability to let go comes through disenchantment and dispassion. Disenchantment can carry a negative connotation, conveying a sense of being disappointed or let down. If people invested time and effort into something, and it did not work out, we may say they gave up and moved on to a new endeavor because they became disenchanted or disillusioned. But disenchantment does not mean disappointment. It means to be free from enchantment. To be disillusioned does not mean to be let down. It is to be no longer caught in illusion. In the old fairy tales, when a sorcerer casts a spell, people become enchanted. They no longer have a sense of reality and are enmeshed in a spellbound world of confusion. Once the spell is broken and they are no longer enchanted, they see the world as it really is. Only then have they reconnected with reality. Similarly, dispassion can connote a feeling of impassivity or indifference. But dispassion does not mean you are detached from yourself or those around you. If you are passionate about something or someone, you are tied to them with strong emotions or desires. You are not only interested or committed, you are swept up in the intoxicating allure of those emotions and desires. To be dispassionate means you are no longer ruled by the passions or caught up emotionally. If you say to loved ones that you are detached from them, it probably is not going to be received very well. If you tell them you are not clinging to them, they will probably appreciate it. Humans are hardwired to attach. It is built into our DNA. Infants must attach to a primary caregiver or they will not thrive. Healthy attachment is an essential part of early childhood development, and those with ambivalent attachment as children may find it hard to form satisfying relationships as adults, or may face other psychological or emotional issues. We are not aiming to disconnect. In fact, we are doing the opposite, connecting with our bodies and minds profoundly, beyond the surface appearance normally accessible. Reflect on how you have been meditating. You close your eyes and draw your attention inward. You cultivate mindfulness and concentration and turn that clear, undistracted awareness directly toward connecting deeply with your body and mind. An equanimous mind is open to all of life, including all parts of you. It does not suppress anything. By now, you have seen how beautiful your mind can be, and you may have also touched places within that you wished were not there. There is no experience you are supposed to have or not have. This is a path of connecting with yourself deeply and profoundly, but remaining disentangled in the midst of it all. Many people find that as equanimity matures, they are more interested in the lives of others and the world around them than ever before. When you are not consumed by the 8 worldly concerns, you are not preoccupied with yourself. When you are not reacting to a situation, you are able to be more present and connected, not less. Rather than feeling detached, you find yourself able to open to and be present with all sorts of situations and people. A mind of equanimity is not consumed with what it can get, but is deeply interested in what it can give. Factors supporting equanimity. The Dharma qualities that support and grow from meditation are like sides of a multifaceted jewel, each reflecting and magnifying light from all the other surfaces. The rays feeding back on each other in a positive, reinforcing cycle. Any one of them is an access point for the others. Intention. All along, we have emphasized the central role intention plays in the course of Dharma practice, especially in those times when you are pulled by forces of desire, negativity, or doubt. Keeping in mind wholesome intentions for how you want to live and act provides a refuge, helping you stay balanced through the many challenges and rewards of a meditative life. Rather than being caught up and swept along by a situation, the clarity of your intention acts as a touchstone, anchoring you in wise and skillful action. Virtue. All of your actions are born from intentions, whether you are aware of them or not. Out of your sincere, wholesome intentions comes virtuous action. By aiming to live with integrity, you dwell peacefully with others, and when your interactions are harmonious, your mind is not agitated by conflict. This leads to a quiet confidence in knowing there is a blameless quality to your life. Gladdening your mind. Living virtuously in alignment with your new intentions, you are more happy and at peace. It is reassuring to know you are on a positive track, using your time well by aiming to create less suffering and more well-being for others and yourself. You feel the goodness of your intentions and the happiness of knowing you have put those intentions into action. Being reassured leads to relaxation and ease. Not stressed or worried, you feel a sense of balance and calm. Mindfulness. Mindfulness provides a space between what happens and your response to it. Within that space rests the freedom to decide whether you will react on impulse or respond through wisdom. It is a moment of choice in the midst of any situation. With mindfulness, when equanimity is present, you know it. When you are thrown off balance, you know that, and you can employ the tools you have built to help you regain composure. Steadiness. As concentration becomes established, equanimity is not so easily shaken. Concentration strings moments of mindfulness together. You can go for long periods caught up in life, going through the motions, unaware of what you are doing. But if you maintain a state of steady undistractedness throughout the day, you become increasingly awake to the present moment. Discernment. Supported by mindfulness and steadiness, you begin to see things as they are, without getting caught up in stories about them. You have the experience to choose the appropriate tools and apply them skillfully in any situation. As patterns of reactivity are recognized through mindfulness and steady presence, the knots of aversion and stress, desire, and attachment begin to unravel. You are naturally open to more happiness, contentment, compassion, wisdom, and peace. Finding the teacher within. Regardless of your situation, you can begin cultivating a quiet mind and an open, compassionate heart. With intention, you can start to use your time more wisely for mindfully connecting with your experience in order to explore the potential for freedom within your life circumstances. With practice, you begin, bit by bit, to awaken to and live more fully in alliance with your own inner wisdom. There comes a time when you are no longer a seeker. You will have arrived at a place of knowing and being, the confluence of the path and the goal. This is not an egotistical place in which you think you have learned all there is to know and no one can tell you anything. It is not saying there is no longer a path to follow and no further work to be done. We cannot see our own blind spots. It would be a mistake to think you never need the guidance and advice of those who have traveled further along the path. We do not want to become arrogant or complacent, thinking we do not need mentors. Otherwise, we risk running into unnecessary cul-de-sacs or bad neighborhoods that would be better avoided altogether. Ultimately, we go from being students to becoming our own teacher. As the Dharma comes alive in you, you will have less need to rely on any outside authority. With time and experience, you will learn to trust your own inner guidance. Your experience will be your guide. The times in any situation when you clearly know what is happening and it is obvious what to do will increase. You will not need to look outside of yourself. The person who splashes in the shallows of the ocean does not find the pearls. If you want to understand, you have to dive deeply, and then you will find them. Through meditation, you open to the deeper truths of yourself and the world around you. You go from being a seeker to resting in the stream of knowing and being as you learn to live equanimously with a quiet mind and an open heart. Thank you for listening to The Art and Skill of Buddhist Meditation, Mindfulness, Concentration, and Insight. Written by Richard Shankman, narrated by Alan Taylor, and published by Wetware Media. This recording is copyright 2016 by Wetware Media. For more information about Wetware Media and to browse more mindfulness and meditation audiobooks, please visit wetwaremedia.com. That's WETWAREMEDIA.com.